From the Clark Ford Studio in Oxford, Mississippi, MBW Digital proudly presents the Oxford Exxon Podcast.
I'd say thanks for tuning in, but why am I going to give you a round of applause for something that you're supposed to do, to be frank?
And now, here are your hosts, Chase Palm.
And broadcast school has really paid off.
And Neil McCready.
I deserve to be on TV.
Welcome to this edition of the NetPar Podcast. Chase Parm, Jeffrey Wright, again for the second week. We're going to put it on the big show's RSS feed. Let a few of you learn about us. Let a few of you listen. Maybe you'll decide to take up golf. Maybe you just enjoy listening to knuckleheads talk a little bit, and you get that today. You also get one guy that's not a knucklehead today, Kevin Weeks, a Golf Digest Top 50 teacher. I think he came in at number 42. In the latest edition, he is the director of development instruction at Cog Hill, just outside Chicago. Jeffrey, you've known Kevin for a while now.
Yeah, he's fantastic. For those that don't know, I played at Ole Miss. He has been living up in the Chicagoland, I think probably over 20 years now, and so he is the director of instruction at Cog Hill, as Chase mentioned. But more importantly, you're going to get to listen to a guy that is in the top 50 of instruction guys. And that is, I mean, even though as club pro guy would, of course, tell us that that's more reputation and just who you know. It's all political, as he would like to point out, that he's not, you know, that he's not exactly included in the list. But nonetheless, Kevin is fantastic. I cannot say enough good things about him.
So we'll get to Kevin here in a little bit. And I talked to Kevin about something that I'm going to have a situation with here soon. My daughter is 2 years old. We talk a good bit about junior golf. And Kevin's a specialist in getting high school juniors into college and letting them take that step. But for the really young kid, when do you get started? How do you get started? When do you get fitted? We go through a lot of those things with Kevin. And just on how do you make it enjoyable for kids where they keep coming back, where, you know, you can put something in front of these kids, they enjoyed it. Because, Jeffrey, you know, Carly Ann is going to be around golf in some aspect her whole life, even if it's just on the Golf Channel in the background when she's sitting in the living room. But I do wonder kind of how you get started, because let's just keep it real here. Not a lot of girls play golf. The pool is still very small. That thing can turn into college scholarships at some point.
Oh, for sure. I mean, like, you know, you look at, all you have to do is kind of look at the scores. Like, you know, look at Division I golf. Look at the men's scores. You know, everyone's a pretty darn good player. And then you look at the women's scores. There's a lot of money out there to be earned for not, let's just say, I wouldn't say that it's all things are equal. So there's definitely the opportunity out there for every Rachel Heck, you know, at St. Agnes, I think's been winning every tournament she's ever entered since she was like 12 and is going to go to Stanford. For every her out there, there's lots of girls on the team that are getting scholarship money just to go and post 85.
Except if you can break 80, college will be paid for somewhere.
I think that's probably fair. I mean, I think it really is. Like, you just, like, you know, Dylan has to cover the SMU women's golf team, and they're not a bad golf team. But, man, you look at the scores, they've only got one player that's consistently in the 70s. And, you know, it is a situation where it's like, oh, there's kind of an untapped market out there. So, but it is that delicate blend, you know. How do you want to be supportive and you want to maybe push them in that direction to maybe, you know, I scratch your back, you scratch my back, we get that college paid for. But then there's also that fine line that you don't want to be Earl Woods or Ty Treon's dad or Sean O'Hare's dad. So there is that delicate balance, and knowing how to find that fine line, I do feel like, is a difficult parenting proposition.
Yeah, it's like in that Netflix documentary, The Short Game, where you had the girl that's being called the Tigress or whatever. Her dad was he basically took Earl Woods as Dr. Spock, the way you should raise a child, and became that guy.
Yeah. Did not think we'd get a Star Trek reference out of you, but nonetheless, definitely fit there. Yeah, it's just kind of that fine line, but it's like at the same time, you know, as much, let's get real, as much of a dick as Earl Woods was as a human being, he did make the single greatest player of all time. Like, you can say he's not, you know, that Jack Nicklaus maybe had a better career and was the better professional golfer, but at his peak, no one was as good as Tiger Woods. And so it's, you know, it's the Joe Jackson reference. It's, you know, how do you beat your kid into greatness, but not beat him so much that he wants to diddle with children? So it's a very, very fine line.
We're about 7, 6, 5 years different in age, something like that. And we had completely different meanings there. Dr. Spock is a pediatrician that was like known for childcare. He died in 1998.
Ah, yeah. Well, Spock for nerds is, is the most brilliant man alive.
Okay. Fair enough. I was just, no, I mean, yeah, you have to tip your hat to Earl Woods at the end of the day. I mean, say what you want, but hey, it's working out all right. It's okay.
And so, as much of a dick as he was, Tiger still talked to him. I mean, I think the worst case is like Sean O'Hare, right? Where you created a, you know, Sean O'Hare is going to have a career that most people that even play college golf would lust to have, like, would give up lots in their life to have Sean O'Hare's career. Yet, you got to wonder for his dad, and you got to wonder from Sean's perspective, like, was that worth it all? Like, to lose your dad over that?
Well, the answer is no. I mean, come on. But
what is, okay, that's a good question. What's enough of a career? If Carly Ann, if I tell you this, that Carly Ann's never going to speak to you after about the age of 25, she's never going to speak to you. She's going to remove you from her life, and she's pretty much going to wake up every single day hating you. What is enough of a career that you go, okay, I got to think about this?
So you're Patrick Reed's parents.
Yeah, but let's say, because I think Patrick Reed's
more low-key. It's not thrown in my face every day.
Well, Patrick Reed's is also, I feel like Patrick Reed's is a different example because Sean O'Hare, I feel like Sean O'Hare and his dad, that is completely like Sean's decision based on his relationship with his dad. Like, there seems to be several factors in Patrick Reed's decision. I'm talking just straight up. It has nothing to do with, you know, who Carly Ann winds up spending her life with, whatnot. It's just her dealings with you forces her to say, I'm never talking to you ever again.
Because in your head, you're going, hey, if we're getting like Annika or Julie Inkster out of this deal, hey.
Right.
Hey.
I mean, and, you know, even, you know, Lydia Ko seems to be back on the up and up. I mean, you know, if we're talking about, you know, let's say NB Park's career. And obviously it's still going.
I don't okay, do we have these psychopath relationships in the LPGA, or is it just not covered enough to know them?
I think it's not covered enough.
Okay.
That seems to be my thought on it.
Yeah, Lydia Ko, who has struggled as much as anyone, she wins her 15th tournament, youngest ever to do that. It hits that 245-yard three wood better than I've hit any club in my entire life on the playoff hole the other night.
Well, see, I've got jailbreak technology now, and let me tell you what, my three wood game has just really, really elevated to new heights. So that 245 into that tucked pin wasn't as impressive to me anymore.
Well, you know that I am basically the Phil Mickelson-level tinkerer for the mid-handicap.
Yeah,
like, without really any ability to do anything with my clubs, I like changing clubs around.
Mm-hmm.
And I have decided that a 5-wood that I found in the garage that I had in 2002 is the key to my season.
Well, yeah, it's got good juju. So that's what you need.
It's got the right shaft in it. Kind of scared to take it out. Probably can't put it in anything else.
Really
tip
fits your eye.
Probably changed. But yeah. It might even replace that driving iron. It's like 215, 220. Pretty good right now.
That's the dumbest thing you've ever said. Like, that is the driving iron. The Crossfire is the only club that, like, you are legitimately replacing the best club in your bag. That's so stupid.
That 5-wood's good.
Yeah, well, replace one of those crappy wedges that you hit. Keep them both. Keep the driving iron and the 5-wood. If that's what your decision is, like,
But if you're my caddy, there's no situation where you would actually hand me the 5-wood over the driving iron.
No, I wouldn't.
Ever.
No. Not even remotely.
So take the 60-degree out of my bag that I literally never hit.
Not only do you never hit, when you try to hit it, it is just not good. Not your best.
I like to think I can hit it out of bunkers, but I really can't.
Yeah, we all like to think that. When we stand above a shot, we like to think, you know, it's 170. There's a touch of wind up there. If I throw this high draw up there with a 7, you know, I can get back to that back left pin. We can't.
I think that's your biggest improvement. You talk about jailbreak technology. You talk about all the things you're doing well. You're hitting one more club more now and actually getting to the middle of greens.
Yeah. No, I've decided step one, which I was pretty good at, was get off the tee, put the ball in play. That's step one. And then step two is find a way to get to the green. And it has lowered my handicap to a depressingly low number right now.
Yeah, not a good number. Not a good place to be heading into the season.
No, and even worse, I thought I was going to turn in a score that was going to help get my handicap back into, shall we say, a strategic leaderboard positioning, if you will, for tournaments. And all it did was like bump out a score that I needed to keep in there, and it lowered it to a 6.8.
Oh, I know. I'm having that same problem. You shoot what you think is a bad score, and you don't realize just how bad you were a year and a half ago.
Oh, God. Well, for me, it was like, because during the winter when I was playing a ton, the ball was going nowhere. I was still playing the back tees because my brother carries it 330 in the air. So I'm still playing those tees, and then there was no grass around the greens, and so you were sculling everything. So, you know, double was, if you weren't hitting greens, you were basically making double. And so all those scores now are getting knocked out, which is just wildly depressing.
I'm going to go to Kevin in a second. Then we're going to come back. We're going to talk a little Quail Hollow, talk a little Wells Fargo. That will begin on Thursday. But kind of last thought here is I'm really kind of getting into where Carly Ann does go grab the club, hit some balls in the yard, do some things. Just 2, 3, 4 is when we'll start to put some sort of emphasis behind this. But how crazy is it? And you, well, probably not crazy at all. You're going to agree here, I think, because you've got the brothers that are great athletes and you're trying to keep up. I have so much more optimism for this because she's adopted. She's not my genes. And I go, hey, she's athletic. She climbs and crawls. I might have a shot here because I actually share no DNA with this child.
Well, on top of that, we've seen a few of her moments in daycare. And let's just say Carly Ann's got the alpha gene. And, you know, not to rip on the girl, but the girl's got the fighting spirit. And you got to think that she's going to have a grinder's mentality on top of probably being able to, I'm going to say, I think if the girl can kind of stand tall on her backside, I think we can maybe get some pretty good driving distance out of that, which would be nice to see with the Parham name.
Yeah, you know, she plays the up tees, yeah. And she's got a little height on her. Yeah, she goes to story time on Saturday mornings, mm-hmm. And she'll share the first toy. That's
yep.
cool.
Yep.
But then
don't
you try to take
second.
The second toy from yeah. her, and she's going to push you down.
Yeah. No, listen, she gave – you know the rules going in.
Yeah. The black teddy bear, fine. Just don't try to grab the red one.
Yes, and hey, those are the rules.
Yeah.
Everybody walks good, in so. Knowing the situation.
But learn some practice rules and more here with Kevin Weeks as we go to him now on the podcast. Kevin, welcome to the show today. We'll hopefully have you on a good bit, so I don't want to do this every single time, but just kind of give a little bit of background. I've already kind of introduced you, told who you are and where you are, but how'd you get there and kind of what was the interest along the way that put you in that position?
Boy, you know, it was a journey to get here. After I graduated from Ole Miss, I worked for my former college coach, Ernest Ross, at the Country Club of Jackson, and he helped me get on at Grand Cypress in Orlando. And I always wanted to teach. I knew I wasn't made out, or my makeup wouldn't allow me to work in the golf shop. It just wasn't me. I need to be outdoors, dealing with people. But the questions that the members ask, I'm not built for stupid questions. And you kind of have to know your deal. And I was always interested in how things worked. And I worked at Grand Cypress. I worked with their golf schools. I taught at John Jacobs Golf Schools. And then I taught with Golf Digest Schools as well. And doing what I've done, I've taught in 33 of the states. And finally, I married a lady from Chicago and was able to get on at Cog Hill. And I've been here now starting my 21st year.
Is it kind of the cliche like you hear sometimes of, you know, you play until you realize, hey, I probably can't play anymore. And then you go, hey, I want to hang around and golf. So let's teach, or is teach even when you were playing something you thought, hey, I could be pretty good at this?
Well, I started golf late. I didn't start till I was 16 years old. So the thought of me playing, I was at Ole Miss with Darren Cole and Dave Peggy, Glenn Day, Chip Sullivan, and Vance Feasey. And I realized I would never be that good. And I was just glad Ernest left me hang around. And I was always interested in why some guys were better than others when it looked like others hit it better. And was always interested in what they were doing and how they were doing it and what made better players better than other players. And I really never had the dream or the thought of playing professional golf. I played a lot of section events. I've played in a lot of state opens. But the playing of pure professional golf, as late as I started, I never had that dream, which in teaching, it really helped me because that's what I did full time or put my interest to full time. Once I got out of college and got into the profession, I wasn't still trying to play and teach. I was pure studying the golf swing, the short game, the putting, the whole thing. So it ultimately helped me out, put me further along in my career. It was a blessing.
Yeah, and you're at a place now where you're getting athletes from other sports, you're getting low handicappers, you're getting a little bit of everything. I mean, you're also, you know, at a club that has hosted the BMW recently. I mean, it's a pretty good mix for, hey, there's something kind of new every day, and it allows you to probably assume to keep broadening what you do.
It really is. I see a little of everything. My main focus is developing good young junior high and high school and college players. Our PGA Junior League team that I've coached here for the last 4 years, the last 2 years, we've been one of 8 teams that have qualified for the national championships in Scottsdale.
A little older, what you're talking about. I got a few just kind of teaching questions, but for the young...
Sure.
For the young kid, for the parents to go, hey, I want my kid to learn golf. I'll deal with this at some point. My daughter's just 2. I've got a little time. Mm-hmm. But what age and kind of what are the first steps to just go trying to even introduce the sport to children?
The best thing to do is make sure they have fun. The best way when your daughter gets a little older, take her to the chipping area, the putting green, let her chip, let her putt just a few minutes. And take a butterfly net, go to the creeks, look for tadpoles and frogs and fish. Make sure they have fun. It's all about them having fun. And if you have some friends that are kids of that age, go out with them and make it a social thing. And as they learn their skills, play scrambles with them, play from their tees. Play scrambles, let them have fun. And I always tell parents and whenever I speak to families and parents is always leave the golf course before the kid is ready to. Don't make them stay, make them leave. Because if you make them leave, they're going to be more likely to want to come back. But if you make them stay, they're not going to want to go back.
Yeah, no, that makes all sense. And, you know, in just... From, I mean, not hardcore, but in any essence of teaching them a swing, mechanics, is there an age or is that more, you know, almost kind of like pornography, you know it when you see it, when they're ready for that?
It's when they show the interest. When they start showing an interest, when they start getting upset with hitting bad shots, that's when I tell the parents, okay, now you can get them some lessons. When they're showing that they're working on their own, when you go downstairs and you see them putting on the carpet, when you see them going out in the backyard hitting dandelions, that's when you know they're interested and they're ready. It's a tough answer, but that's truly the way to do it. And also one of the big mistakes people make is they think, okay, I've got a kid. Boy, I don't know if they're going to like it or not. I'm just going to go to the cheapest teacher, let them get it, have a lesson with that. I would rather them take a 30-minute lesson from a really good, experienced teacher than an hour or longer group with someone who's less experienced?
With dropship and putt, you've got US Kids, you've got First Tee, you've got all these different organizations, you've got different ways to try to get kids involved in the game. And everybody always has the whole, well, you know, golf's shrinking, golf's dying, golf's doing this. How are we doing as a country or even a golf society for, you know, increasing the level for kids and giving them opportunities to play? Is it better than it was 10, 15 years ago?
Giving them opportunities to play is much better than it was 15 years ago. When the game was booming, they didn't want to take the time for the kids to play. Now that the courses aren't full, they're doing a lot of initiatives, and the drive, chip, and putt has done a lot to raise awareness for playing. But the programs that I've seen that are really moving the needle as far as getting the masses to play is the PGA Junior League. We've taken our program, 5 years ago we had 18 players. This past year we had 102. That's growth. And it's bringing members, it's bringing kids who are wanting to come out and play. They're playing a scramble. They're having a blast doing it. And it's not about winning. It's about having fun, learning a little bit. And that program is really, in our area especially, junior golf, the tours are packed with juniors that are playing.
You know, I've got a lot of people listening that aren't necessarily golf fans. We're early on in this podcast. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people that go, hey, I like Chase or Jeffrey. They listen to one of our other MPW digital offerings and go, I'm going to listen to this one too. But maybe they have somewhat of an interest in golf. So I want to spend some time on the newcomer because I'm kind of like that. I played golf in high school. I picked it up when I had Tommy John surgery. I was a pitcher. I got hurt. Mm-hmm. When I was coming back, I said, I need something competitive to pass time. So I played golf. I wasn't very good, but said, hey, let's give this a chance. And then kind of dropped the game for about 10 years, picked it back up 2 or 3 years ago and become obsessed with it. And for the person that goes, hey, I like this. I don't have a lot of time, but hey, let's figure this out. Let's start here. For someone that's just learning or is trying to improve, they go, well, the money maybe isn't there to do this, but does it help? Would you suggest fitting for the newcomer to the game off the bat?
Fitting a little bit, yes. You don't need to go get everything. You don't need to get the highest tech shaft, but you need the right length club, the right grip size, and the right lie angle. The lie angle is the angle at which the shaft sits to the ground, and that really affects, especially for a new golfer, because a lot of times they get old hand-me-down clubs. If it's fit for somebody else with a really bad lie angle or the wrong weight shaft, golf's going to be harder for them to pick up than if it's the right length, the right lie, and the right shaft.
So basic things just to not hinder you is the main point.
Correct. That's correct.
And then I kind of had this problem this morning a little bit. I went out to the driving range. I didn't have time to play, but I said, I'm just going to hit balls. I'm going to practice, work on some things. And even now, as long as I've played pretty routinely every week, I have to catch myself to not rake balls over and to reset at the driving range. Is that one of the biggest keys for efficient practice? Because I feel like that pretty much every golfer goes, hey, I hit a bad shot, grab me another one, instead of having some type of purpose to the work they're putting in when none of us have hours to sit out in the range and hit 400 golf balls.
Absolutely. When I set my range up for my lessons or my group class or my junior practices, the bucket of balls is 10 feet behind the hitting station where they have to hit one ball at a time. And there's a couple of them that they're on a clock. I have my assistant sit there, and they can't hit a ball faster than one every 45 seconds because I want the practice to be more mental than physical. You hit a shot, go through your practice swings, go through your cues on whatever you're doing, hit another ball.
I know you're seeing a lot more low handicaps and juniors with some type of competitive level, but What are kind of some of the keys or the common mistakes that you see for the high handicapper or the beginner?
swinging too hard. They're mistaking effort instead of swing speed. A drill that will really help the average player or the bad player, because let's face it, the most important club in your bag is your driver. If they will take tee up four drivers, making a full swing, hit the first ball 100 yards, the second ball 150, the third one 200, and then the fourth one, go ahead and hit it, keeping the tempo the same until halfway down, that was something that will really help the average to the newer golfer.
You say driver most important simply because you can't start the hole if you can't put it in the fairway?
Break them down in statistics. I love you guys break down the baseball, the sabermetrics of baseball. They've done the same thing with golf. And if you take a look at the top players in the world, or anybody that's ever dominated their era, they were also one of the longest hitters in the game. Nicklaus, Tiger, Palmer, they were all Annika Sorenstam. They all bombed it. So if you can hit the ball between the trees long, golf's a lot easier.
How does that translate with the average player, just the recreation player, though, for the amount of time they do different things? Because I'm kind of guilty of this. I don't drive the ball very, very poorly at all, but I feel like, hey, I'm not making many putts, so I'm going to sit on the green and putt all day. And I get moving towards your weakness, but I think sometimes we don't realize that, hey, the pro misses that 8-footer half the time, too. I think that with TV golf, we become so accustomed to them making every putt that we don't really even know what average is on the greens for a pro or the average player these days.
Oh, I agree. That's one of the things I did in the program last year for my competitive players. I printed it out, the stats on where they make. And, you know, when you get out to 6 feet, it's 50-50. And a tour player is more likely to three putt at 28 feet than they are to make it. So you spend a lot of time with the putter, second most important club, and then the driver. Those are the two that you can really make up a lot of strokes. And for the average person who doesn't hit it or is hitting a lot of fairways, then spend more time with the putters and the wedges. That's where you can go online and get stats programs, keep in your stats, and they'll show you where you're strong and where you're weak.
What are some basic drills for putting, for just making sure that you're aligned correctly, and obviously you have a stroke that's somewhat routine that you can repeat over and over and over again?
Two of my favorite drills are literally taking the ruler out of your garage, find the flattest spot in your house, and learn to roll the ball down that ruler. That will help you learn to control the face angle at impact. And then when you go to the golf course, put a carpenter's chalk line down on a straight putt of about 5 feet. And once again, do the same thing. Learn to hit the ball down the line straight. Because where the putter is aiming at impact, it's the most important thing in putting. Path really is not that big of a deal in putting. I've done some research with my putting robot, and you can swing a putter on a 10-foot straight putt into out. And if it's facing a target, the ball will go in the hole every time.
Putting robot, what all does this thing do?
I've got a putting robot doing some research, and it literally, I can get this thing to do whatever I want it to do. If I need to hit it up, if I want it to hit down, if I want to open the face, close the face, to see path and face, to see how loft affects face angle at impact, I can get it to do whatever I want it to do. so I can study how the ball comes off the face to find out truly what's important in putting and what's not.
So what have you learned to this point? Is there one or two takeaways that maybe surprised you?
That putting is 95% of where a ball goes is pure putter face, aim and impact. There really isn't a correlation between face aim and address and impact. I've had 52 tour players come through my putting lab, and not one of, maybe two or three of them aimed within half a degree. I was able to work with two of the better players in the world, and neither one of them aimed within 3 degrees of square. But at impact, they were both 0.2 and 0.1 every time. And that was pretty eye-opening. And the fact that the path really doesn't do have any influence on how the ball rolls was one of the other ones. And when I first did that, I had just written just a proven article for Golf Digest of how important path was in putting. And literally 3 days later, we run with it. I ran these tests, and I immediately called Matt Rudy with Golf Digest and said, "Hey, Matt, listen, we need to squash that article. It's not right." He said, "I went to press yesterday." That wasn't one of my finer moments, Chase. Whoops.
Yeah, no, I understand. Last couple things here. So we've talked about how to spend time at the range. For the 10 to 50, 15 handicapper, he plays twice a week. He's got about 30 minutes to practice on a Tuesday afternoon. Driver, putter, taking up 25 of those 30 minutes?
Yes. Yeah, getting loose. And if it's a course you don't play much, go hit a few little wedge shots around the green to get a feel for how the ball's reacting on that golf course, warm up. And what I would tell them to do is the last few minutes right before you go, play on the range, play the first two holes of the golf course. Pick your target, hit your drive, then whatever you would normally hit for your second shot, hit that, and then play the second hole and go to the tee.
Yeah, I've convinced myself when I have a little more time that that's the most effective practice I have is to play the whole course on the range. Hit a drive, figure out kind of, for a course that I know especially, hey, this was going to be in the right rough. Well, now this shot's going to be about this distance. And play through it where it does put some sort of a mental test to you other than just swinging the club, kind of like we were talking about earlier.
Well, absolutely. And when you're doing that, you're changing clubs. You're going through your routine. You're not hitting and raking.
The Wells Fargo this week, back at Quail Hollow after hosting a major last year. Just kind of what your thoughts, who sets up well. Obviously, Rory's had a lot of success there in the past.
It's a great golf course. They got 17 great holes there. Big fan of that golf course. It's a big boy golf course. It really favors somebody that turns the ball right to left. Another one this week to watch for would be Ricky Fowler. That would be that type player plays well there. You have to hit a lot of shots, but it's mostly a predominantly drawing golf course. In fact, there was one guy I was working with his rookie year. He played, liked to play it left to right. And middle of the practice round, he calls me. And he says, "Hey, Weeksy, this golf course doesn't like me. Everything's right to left, and I play left to right. But what do I do?" I go, "How many tournaments are you in?" He goes, "I'm in the next five." I go, "Withdraw." He yells across the fairway to his caddy, "Hey, we're out of here. Pick it up. Let's go." Because you can't play every week, and you have to pick the courses that suit you. And playing right to left didn't suit him at all, so he took the week off. So if any of these people listening, if you're in a fantasy league, look for your drawers this week.
Or, I mean, Phil can play the cut. He's in the field.
Correct.
Yeah.
That would be a good cut. Well, you have to drive it pretty straight.
Okay.
And that kind of that course has got some areas for Phil that could be issues. It's open in spots, but it's got three or four holes that you kind of have to thread the needle in. That's not his forte, hitting needles with his driver.
You've said 17 great holes. What's the one that sticks out and why for not being very good?
17. That tee just doesn't fit. That tee shot doesn't fit that green complex. As rounded as that green is, the angle at which that tee sits to that green, it just isn't. It's a really, really almost no chance to get it close. And the penalty for missing it is too severe at that distance where they have them play it. I don't think the green was designed for that length from that angle. But other than that, it's just a fantastic golf course. It's one of three courses that I would want to go back and play, but I would just go from 16 green to 18 tee.
Is that one of the dangers that as we keep lengthening these things and doing all these things is just that they don't fit the areas and the green complexes and the way the ball comes in no longer is manageable for the holes?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. And the greens aren't designed speed-wise to ever designed to putt that speed. That was one of the things at Cog Hill. We couldn't have our greens are so undulated and the ridges are so severe, you couldn't get the greens for the tournament over 11, because if you did, there was some places, if you were on the wrong spots, you couldn't putt it from there. It's one of the things I don't like when they take a short par 5 and turn it into a long par 4, because most of the time short par 5s have small greens, bunkers, they're mounded, that's that hole's protection. And then when you make that a long par 4, that green's not designed for 4-iron in. That green's designed to be tricky to get your tension with a wedge or a sand wedge, where now you've got 4 or 5-iron in.
You've mentioned a second ago about somebody withdrawing because the course didn't suit their eye, but is there something in the top of your head? You work for a lot of pros, a lot of very, very successful pros, or worked with, I guess would be the way to put it. Mm-hmm. Have there been one or two that just for whatever reason, mentally, does one stick out for a course that maybe should fit them, but for whatever reason, the results were bad or didn't fit their eye in a way that you would have expected it to?
Well, until he won last year, I thought Sergio would have been a lock to win 2 or 3 Masters. It boggled my mind that Sergio didn't play better at Augusta, because he hits his iron so good and he drives it really, really well. That was the one that surprised me, that he didn't win that tournament more often.
Hopefully I'll speak to you before this again, but Shinnecock Hills here in a few weeks. What's kind of the makeup of that course for the field?
Oh, that's number one on my to play list. If you look at what it was last time, they let the golf course get away from them. It is a ball strikers golf course. It will be a great test for an Open champion, for a U.S. Open championship. Really looking forward to watching that one.
Kevin, as always, we appreciate it, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
All right, Chase. Thanks. Good luck.
Thanks to Kevin. You're going to be hearing a lot from him on this show as we keep going. A great friend of ours, a great friend of the MPW Digital Network. We'll get some stories. Kevin's worked with a lot of professionals over the years, guys who've won tournaments, won big tournaments. He coaches athletes, celebrities, and more in that Chicagoland area. So, Kevin, a huge resource to us, and we really do appreciate it. And, Jeffrey, you have lived in that area around Quail Hollow, or not too terribly far away, and Kevin likes Ricky this week.
Yeah, so I was up in Winston, so I was about an hour and 15 minutes north, and, you know, there's so many good golf courses in North Carolina, and I kind of get why. You know, obviously Donald Ross kind of made home base there, but, of course, Maples and Maxwell were also kind of Donald Ross guys, so they've were involved in a lot of great golf courses there too. So tremendous golf. The weird thing though is, so Quail Hollow was redone in for the PGA Championship. They major championshiped it up. So they bring in Fazio. Although I've never figured out. I can't tell. This is like another one of those blowhard things where I've always thought it's Tom Fazio, but then you'll get some guys that say Tom Fazio, and I can't tell if it's like if it's actually just be like Tom Fazio or Tom Fazio, Fazio. Like, I don't know actually how to do it because I can't tell if people are just being pretentious or if people just have, like, Yankee accents when they say his name.
When 96% of the population says Fazio, it's Fazio. Anyone else is just being stupid.
Right, so yeah.
Or trying. No, they're being a try too hard. They're not being stupid.
And even if your name is Fazio, at that point, you're Fazio, right?
Well, I deal with that.
Well, it's like, isn't it technically like
it's never pronounced correctly. Okay, fine.
Isn't it technically the Joe Theismann? Like, at a certain point, they wanted Theismann to rhyme with Heisman, so they changed it to Theismann, but really his name is actually Theismann?
Is it? I don't know that story.
Yeah.
Is that true?
And the same thing, who was it? Marcel, we always said it was Marcel Darius, but he never corrected anyone. It was really Marcel Darius. So, like, at a certain point, are you just Marcel Darius?
Well, I mean, I cover Ole Miss baseball. I covered an outfielder named Austin Bousfield who didn't change it with us, who talked to him every day and said his name for 3 years. It was in his junior season before he corrected us.
I did forget about that. That's a good example. But so with the changes that they made to Quail Hollow, it's basically turned it into a bomber's paradise. Like, you look at the PGA Championship leaderboard, it's no surprise that, you know, Justin Thomas was there. I guess technically Patrick Reed being up there. I mean, it's not like Patrick Reed's short, but he's certainly... You're not putting him in, like, the bombers category. So if you're really looking for guys this week, I mean, you need, you know, it's going to be the names that you know and love. It's going to be the names that just kind of bomb and gouge it. It's going to be Justin. It's going to be Ricky. It's going to be Rory. Hideki usually plays pretty well there. So it seems to be that it's going to be, like, those kinds of guys again.
So what do we do with this one? I don't think he's a pick for me in fantasy. I haven't locked in my final picks yet. I've made my preliminary picks on the off chance I forget later and there's something in the bank. But it's Webb Simpson's home course. Is he worth the $1.50 or whatever it is?
Oh, I don't know if you know this, but also his father-in-law, his grandfather-in-law is the starter there, and he introduces him every single time. I don't know if you've heard that.
Ooh, yeah.
Heads up, you're gonna hear that narrative on television coverage. That'll be there. I mean, how many guys, like, really always, like, win on their home course? Like, at a certain point...
And what does it matter? They all saw it preparing for it for a year in major championship form a few months ago.
And on top of that, they play it every single year. Like, I get it. They've made some changes, but I think this is kind of the other thing that gets lost on maybe even the guy who's a good club golfer versus these guys. Local knowledge kind of matters to us because the difference between shooting 85 and shooting 78 is probably making those 10 footers that you know exactly where they break and you're standing over it confidently. You put a good stroke on it. Like, that kind of local knowledge matters. But all of these guys have the yardage books with the putt breaks on them. They all play. I don't think the average fan realizes how conservatively most of them actually play, like, with the exception of, like, Phil. Like, the reason, like, the guys that kind of, like, play ultra-aggressive, like, they stand out because no one else does it because most of them they're pretty conservative. Hey, take the club that gets you in the fairway. We're all good enough iron players. Hit the club pin high and then go, you know, make the putt. And, like, that's kind of how they all play. When they get in trouble, they play the conservative shot that gets them out of trouble. They're all good enough wedge players that if they have to chip it up, they're not worried about, you know, giving themselves a decent look to make par. Like, they all kind of play that way. So I just don't know how much local knowledge really matters at that level because most of what would be considered local knowledge to a club pro, or I mean to a club guy, is not really what they would consider. I mean, they've already got, to me, like, the hardest thing is going to be the breaks and the greens, and they all have the detailed yardage books that show every break on every putt.
Webb Simpson T2 in 15 the year Rory ran away with it.
Yeah, nothing like a good solid Webb Simpson backdoor T2.
I mean, it's low rent Matt Kuchar there, but it's on the books. So,
ooh, toss up. Whose career would you rather have? He's got the U.S. Open, and as much as I love to like kind of vomit at his golf swing, that dude shot 68 at the Olympic Club on a really tough day. Like,
you want Webb's career over Kuchar?
I do. I think if you gave Kuchar his career, I think he'd take it.
He's got the major.
I mean, I guess the question is, if you're Kuchar, how much value do you put on your Players Championship?
Well, not the value that's on a U.S. Open. I mean, with all love to the Players, no. Not even close.
So, like, that's how I look at it. Like, at a certain point, they're all rich. Like, Webb Simpson, I don't think there's anything in his life that he can't do. You know, he lives an hour from his hometown. Like, he lives in Charlotte. He lives in a mansion. He's a member at Quail Hollow. Like, if you're growing up and you're Webb Simpson, what is on his... Is there any more amount of money that would make you happier? I mean, I guess the answer is yes, you can never have too much money, but it's not like Webb is now done playing golf.
He's got a U.S. Open. He's got four PGA wins. He's got the Wyndham. He's got a wraparound win at the Shriners.
Yeah,
and then
love
he
those.
Did win the playoff event at the Deutsche Bank.
Like, I think I take Webb's career.
Which means if he won the Deutsche Bank, he had to finish pretty high in the FedEx Cup in 11.
Yeah.
Which means he's got some cash from that, too.
Well, I mean, he's got cash because he's just been on tour for so long.
Because golfers have cash, yeah.
Yeah, like, he's got one of the low-key most awful wives on tour. You know, I'm sure he's happy.
Kuchar has 7 wins, mm-hmm. does have a bronze medal in the Olympics.
Yeah, and he backdoored it. God dog it, do I love that guy. Love him.
He's got the RBC Heritage. He's got the Memorial. He's got the Match Play Championship, kind of like that one.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the Players, the Barclays, the Honda, and the Turning Stone Resort Championship. Let's all remember that one.
Who could forget?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, listen, he understands when the cash is at its highest, he's at his finest.
He is a money machine.
Again, he is a hero. He is a professional golfer. Emphasis on professional.
He's a better Charles Howell.
He's the gold standard of Chucky Three Sticks.
Yes. That's,
when Chucky
yes.
Three Sticks wakes up in the morning, he just looks at Matt Kuchar. He pulls up Matt Kuchar's career earnings, pulls up Matt Kuchar's career, and he puts that above his door frame, and he just slaps that, and he goes to work. Play like Cooch today.
So where are we putting it? Do we believe in Rory this week?
No. I do not believe in Rory this week.
We're staying away from Brooks Koepka. The heck with that until he shows some form.
Man, I don't know about you, but wrist injuries scare the crap out of me.
The U.S. is going to be in a really tough spot if he is not healthy when it gets Ryder Cup time, because I think he has enough points to still make the team right now.
Yeah, but it's not going to be like a Vandeveld thing. Like, if you told me Koepka figures it out by September, I'm not really that worried.
J-Day this week?
Gross. I would rather bet on... I would rather, honestly, who else? Let's see who else is in the field I'd rather bet on.
All right, here's the top 10 in the field. Norin at 10.
I'd rather bet on Norin. I got it. I would rather bet on Ryan Moore than bet on Jason Day.
Okay.
I hate betting on Jason Day. Like, he's such a... It is this weird deal with Jason Day. He's arguably, like, one of the best, like, grinders. Like, when I say grinders, I mean, like, around the greens, getting up and down and making par. But he just feels like a mental just dummy, doesn't he?
It's just the dramatics. I don't believe in any of that stuff for the most part. I think there's sympathy votes with some of the injury stuff and the fake injuries in the middle of rounds. I don't think the meditation is needed, at least to that level. I'm not saying that some sort of mental whatever is not a good thing, but not to that level where you have to stand back for 10 seconds and stare for every shot.
Hit the shot.
Yeah.
Hit the shot. I don't know. This is a weird... So this is like a weird part of the schedule for me because I like the field. It's, hey, let's get real. Like, we got Tiger back. We got Phil in the field. We got Rory. We got Justin. We got Ricky. We got some really, really good names. And then next week, of course, is obviously the Players. But I don't know about you, but after the Masters, like, there's just such a drop off. Like, you get that we've kind of broken up the Texas swing. And so it kind of helps you figure out, oh, yeah, they're in San Antonio right now, or they're, you know, you're not having to do the, is this the Colonial? Is this the Byron Nelson? Is, or whatever they're calling it now. You're not quite as in Texas swing, neutral, I don't care golf, but it does feel like we're trying to manufacture some enthusiasm right now.
It is. It's going to be helped a little bit next year with the switch in schedule. You're going to get the PGA in May. You're going to get the Players really early next year. It's the last year we're having to deal with this. And then in your hometown, you're going to get incessant complaints about the heat in Memphis in August.
Yeah, and I'm already ready for it because you know there's nothing I love more than a good golf whining.
It's going to be a great golf whining. I mean, it's going to be the 99 Women's Open in Mississippi times 1,000.
Ooh, no, no, no. I think we have the makings of Chambers Bay 2.0. Which I
really?
I still think to this day is the gold standard. It's the absolute gold standard.
All because of the heat. Because the course is going to be pretty tough, frankly.
And not only that, they're putting, you know, I think normally, that is the great thing if you're a member at Southwind. And, like, for instance, this year in the Memphis area and in Oxford as well, everyone can relate, we had so much rain in the first 3.5 months of the year that it overflooded golf courses. And no one's golf course was able to grow in because on top of the just the excessive amounts of water and the desire for every single club out there to want to get those cart fees, just start shaking everyone down for those cart fees. People were driving on top of them. And on top of that, like when they're flooded, they can't grow in because water needs oxygen to grow. And when it gets flooded, there's not as much oxygen. And then you add in the fact that it's really, I think this is like the first week we're going to have consecutive days in the 80s. And so the temperatures have been really cold. It just hasn't allowed golf courses to grow in. So if you're a course like basically anywhere else in Memphis, like you're just having to bite the bullet and you're going to have to resod, you know, probably I guess starting now. But if you're Southwind, you just make that phone call to the tour and they come and they patch that bad boy up. Yeah, here's $1 million. Let's go get those fairways looking good. And on top of that, for the WGC, they're basically going to have, I mean, you don't want to say an unlimited budget, but they're going to have darn near an unlimited budget to make sure that the golf course is in shape in August.
That's what I was going to ask you. Switching from a second-tier event to a WGC, what does that mean from a resource standpoint from the tour?
Oh, I mean, right now, if you've got the cash, I can't recommend, and this is a hashtag free ad, if you got the cash, I'd go join Southwind because they're about to pump, you know, if you made me guess, over the next 12 months, I bet they pump $4 million into it.
Over under 40 of the top 50 show up.
Over. Guaranteed event.
Okay.
And on top of that, you got to remember,
how many skip Mexico?
I want to say, so J-Day,
Rory didn't go.
J-Day skipped, Rory skipped, but Rory did play last year.
Okay.
Like, that's the other thing. It's a guaranteed money event. They're going to be playing for, what is it, like 1.8? It's a limited field. They're going to whine and they're going to complain, but they're going to whine and complain as they have to show up. I think it's 3 or 4 years down the line that's where we start to really wonder. But, I mean, that's kind of the deal. It's like, hey, FedEx, I tip my cap to them. You know, FedEx said, hey, you've got something you want. We've got something we want. You want us to pay for this event. Best I can tell, the FedEx Cup playoffs, best I can tell, they're not lined up 10 deep to want to pay for this. We're happy to do that if you move the WGC after Bridgestone wants to move theirs to Japan. If you move the WGC to Memphis, we're happy to make this happen. And guess what? Money talks.
It's last thing today, Tiger changing irons this week. He's in the field at Wells Fargo.
Wait, hold on. Is he changing irons, or did he just add that one iron or whatever, that driving iron?
No, TaylorMade got his clubs ready now. He was using a prototype or whatever, and now they've actually announced the TW Phase 1 whatever.
So they were able to finally get Mura to put TaylorMade Tiger Phase 1 on his irons.
Oh, it's my favorite Jeffrey thing.
Good for them.
It's my favorite thing. You think he's hitting the same iron he's been hitting since 1997?
I think the only time he changed irons was when Nike was the only company that stood by him after the scandal, and because he was so grateful that that
he
check,
hit those god awful vapors.
They were the pro combos. They were like the three, four, five were like cavity back, and then as you went farther down, they got more blade like. But I think that's the only time. I think he went Nike from, and even if, dude, he was even putting with that Nike putter. Remember, the mill work was like zigzagged.
Yep.
Like he was putting with that. Like that. I think that's the only time he's ever truly played Nike stuff. Dude, I love how everyone thinks I'm being a conspiracy theorist about this, and he even admitted that his ball was a Bridgestone ball that had a Nike swoosh stamped on it. He admitted it when he signed with Bridgestone.
Yeah, right now I just pulled it up. His irons this week, 3 to pitching wedge, TaylorMade TW Phase 1 prototype, still obviously with the Dynamic Gold X100s.
Yeah. So,
Wedges are Nike VR Pro Forge 56 and 60s.
Which I still, that proves to me that those are not Nike wedges. The fact that he's still hitting those.
Still hitting Nike wedges.
Like, that's case in point. Like, I don't know if they're Vokies, I don't know if they're Clevelands, I don't know if they're Mizunos, I don't know if they're Mura, I don't know what they are, but I know what they're not. They ain't Nike.
So why is he doing that? Why not put stamping for TaylorMade on your wedges?
Because he has always been that guy, man. Like, he has always been the slowest to adopt new equipment. I mean, the guy was still, like, when everyone's, one of the biggest reasons why the guy's being able to swing it so hard right now is not only the fact that, okay, he's got bionic back, and so now he's a cyborg, but on top of that, for the first time in his career, he's swinging the same graphite shaft that everyone else swings, and so it was like going from, you know, a 48-inch, like, super thick steel shaft, and now he's swinging, like, it's like when you, like, he's basically, he put the donut on his bat, and now he's knocked the donut off, and he goes and swings free and easy.
Yeah, he went from a True Temper Dynamic Gold that was built in my hometown to finally the Mitsubishi Orange thing.
Yeah, so that's itself going to bring some swing speed.
He's, just for those curious, he's still hitting the M3 in the driver in the 3-wood and then the M1 in the 5-wood.
Well, it's just about minimizing your misses.
It is. Yes. Tough out there. You know, twist face technology and whatnot.
All right, so where are we putting his chances? Because there's a Tiger on Fazio's. There's a lot of trouble off the tee.
Yeah, it's too tight. He is going to make the cut and finish 25th to 50th, even though he is the only player on tour currently, top 10 around the green and top 10 putting.
Okay, so where are we? So if we're trying to predict Tiger's schedule, so we know he's got this. We know he's got next week at the Players, the whatever they're calling the tournament in D.C. I have no idea what it's called, but I think it's the last year.
The Quicken Loans National.
Right, and I think it's the last year Quicken Loans is sponsoring that because Quicken Loans wanted to move a tournament to Detroit, and they are doing that. So that, but that tournament benefits his foundation. So we know he's playing that. He'll play the U.S. Open. We know he'll play the British Open. He'll play the PGA. He'll play Bridgestone. So right there, that's 6 more events.
And he's already going to play the Memorial, I would think.
Yeah, Memorial. Sorry, that was a brain fart. He'll definitely play the Memorial.
Yeah, he's going to play the Memorial. So that gives him, and that gives a couple weeks off. So he's got Players May 10th. He'll skip Byron Nelson. He'll skip Fort Worth, because duh. And then he will. Colonia would be a disaster for him, by the way.
I don't think he'll play. I don't see him playing either of those.
Yeah, he'll go to Memorial. He'll skip TPC Southland, obviously. He'll play the Open. The National, I think, is just what it's called now. And that's about it, dude.
Because I don't see him playing. He never plays the week before major, so I don't think he'll play the Scottish Open. I guess, is there the chance that, what weekend is the Irish Open? Is there a chance that Rory twists his arm and says, please come play?
I don't know. Let's find out. Everybody will stick with us for a second.
I guess my biggest question is is the Irish Open the week of like the Quicken Loans National, whatever they're calling it, the National?
And if it is, obviously they have no chance there. I just can't see him going over there. Maybe I'm wrong, but I just don't. To me, it is July 5th this year.
So I think
July
that
5th is the same week as the Greenbrier.
And he has played the Greenbrier before.
That would give him three of 4 weeks playing, but he would have a week off after the Open before he played the National and the Greenbrier, and then have another week before he played the Open.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's no way he does that.
Then
we'll have Bridgestone.
He's
PGA.
Got a lot of work to do to get eligible for the Bridgestone.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. He's not even qualified to play for it right now.
No. And he's not going to go do any kind of RBC event or anything like that. So, does he have a top five the rest of the year?
I'll say yes.
Okay.
I mean, like, you look at it, like, he's the difference between this comeback and every other comeback is this isn't as smoke and mirrors as the rest of them were. I do think the one thing that is interesting, and this would be a fun debate to have with someone smarter than we are on this, or someone that understands golf more. It would be interesting. I feel like Tiger, basically ever since he started working with Hank Haney, he went to a more conservative style of golf, and you know, take trouble, you know, take one side of the golf course out of play off the tee. So he started hitting that cut with a driver, and that's all he's exclusively hitting that, because he's been the best iron player his entire life. The whole point is, hey, put yourself in the fairway and then let everyone else, you know, you're the best putter that's ever lived. You're certainly the best pressure putter that's ever lived. Like let's put ourselves in chances. And so I am curious to see. I feel like now with so much money, we even talked about, though, like in general, guys play more conservatively than we think they do. But there are guys, like these younger guys take way more chances than he does. Like, I felt like that was kind of the issue at the Valspar down the stretch. Like, he was not hitting bad shots. He was just hitting safe shots. And because he was hitting safe shots, it felt like he was just in neutral the whole time. And so I do wonder with all of this money, and now where guys don't really care, like it's more of, you know, I'd rather cash the check. Yeah. So I am curious to see if he struggles with that adjustment.
Like, because he should be the ultimate guy to just, hey, pull out the big stick and let's go.
Well, and he's got to be another guy that's hoping that, you know, some of these, you know, you keep hearing a lot of people that are around the USGA. If you've noticed, they've started getting away from golf's toughest test, like that whole mantra, and they think it's because they received too much backlash from that. And so I'm not saying that like every U.S. Open is going to wind up like last year, because last year I think was an anomaly. Like, you had a wide open.
They got terrible weather for a bad round of golf last year, put it that way.
A wide open golf course that was
with
wet.
No protection.
Right. So, and the wind, and usually that, like, I've played that course when it's windy, and I legitimately have never seen a harder piece of property in my entire life. Like, that thing was 20 miles an hour wind. It was baked out. Like, it was impossible. Like, it was so hard that we played Whistling Straits the next day, and Whistling Straits felt like a pitch and putt. Like, that's how hard that golf course was the day that I played it. So I think last year's an anomaly, but like, what if the USGA starts getting more and more okay with like 10 under winning? Like, Tiger's used to winning US Opens around even par and just grinding it out and beating everyone by letting, you know, by just being essentially tougher. And I do wonder, like, if that whole mindset goes, and, you know, I'm not going to say that it's going to come like a PGA championship, but like, I think the scores could start being a lot more similar to like Augusta.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. Yeah, if nothing else, some of the really hard events just in the regular calendar, as opposed to the even par kind of mess.
Well,
so.
And even like when you look at like Augusta, you know, ever since Fazio made the changes to Augusta in 06. He hasn't won there. Like, ever since they made the big major rebuild, he's not won.
He's going to have a good chance on so many of these courses, even not driving it straight, because they're still not putting the rough up to the level where he can't hit out of. He can still bomb and gouge to a certain extent.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It is weird how it is kind of a nice, it's a nice reminder. Like, you watch the Tiger on the range with driver, and he's like absolutely peppering it. Like, he looks just so good. And then as soon as he stands on that first tee, it's just like he completely forgets what he's doing. Like, it is nice to know that, yeah, I know what that feels like.
He hits a lot of first tee bad shots.
Ooh, boy,
his entire career, he's been awful on the first tee.
And it was, you know what? It was really nice to see just a good, solid double cross on 16 at Bay Hill. Like, it's just nothing like watching. There's nothing like watching the guy that was legitimately the best at what he did for a decade plus stand on a tee and just hit a nice double cross.
Well, I mean, I know it was a horror show for you and your boy, but Rory almost missed the ball on number one at Augusta.
Yeah, no, that was great.
Almost missed it.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Hey, so. Patrick Reed just intimidated him, right?
That's exactly what it was. That's why he kept on his pullover, you know, didn't want to show the pink, too. He had to let Patrick have the pink. So, anyway, Kevin Weeks on today. Appreciate his time. We'll be back next week with more golf commentary from people smarter than us and us as well. Talk to you then.